This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
Welcome to this episode of Fairways and Greens. I'm your host, Gaylord Rhodes, the Vegas golf coach. And after 30 years as a golf professional, teacher, and coach, I decided it was time to share the knowledge and insights into the world of golf that I have gathered during my career as a golf professional. And joining me each episode will be a special guest from the golf industry. Together, we will discuss and share their insights, expertise, knowledge, and stories from their career and life in golf as well. Hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, I welcome and appreciate your input and suggestions for future shows, as well as your questions. So feel free to reach out and get in touch with me, the Vegas Golf Coach, by emailing me at info@golfcoachpodcast.com. That's info@golfcoachpodcast.com. Reach out and let us know what's on your mind and what you're thinking about. So let's get started with today's show. So let's get today's show about the Ryder Cup started. What an incredible win for the Americans, 17-11, amazing. And but what an event! I mean, from the very get go, for us to sweep the first four matches on Friday was incredible. Hadn't been done since 1975. The last time it was done was when Palmer was on the team. And of course, having Palmer's bag on the first tee and dedicating the Ryder Cup this year to Arnold was an incredible compliment to him and to his life, and very well received by all the members of both teams and the audience. What an incredible audience! Over 50,000 people each day. Unfortunately, as most of you know who watched it, there were some unruly members of the crowd, but overall, I think it was a great event. Unfortunately, they didn't police it as well in the beginning, and it kind of got out of hand at times. But you know, it's going to happen over there. It happens over here. It's unfortunate that we get golf fans now that don't appreciate and honor the history and the of this event and the respect that they should have for these golfers. Whether we win or lose, it's really about the matches and about the teamwork and excitement that's created by this event, and not about personally abusing the other team to win. So, but that's kind of an American thing in most sports. So I get it, and it's all good. The Patrick Reed McIlroy singles match on Sunday was one of the finest, incredible Ryder Cup matches I've ever seen, in the sense that they were both pumped up, fired up, just trading shot for shot, and then hugging each other and pump fisting. And I mean, it was just good. It was good theater. It was good atmosphere. It was good to see those two guys at the top of their game battling it out. And of course, to see Patrick Reed win was just phenomenal. But I don't think Roy should be disappointed at all. It was a great match. It was what the Ryder Cup's all about. And I really enjoyed that. It was really good to watch. And then, of course, there was the Phil Mickelson Sergio Garcia match. Both of them ended disappointed in a half, but can you imagine two players shooting 63? Both of them shot 63 in that final singles match that they played together in the third spot. And it was interesting to watch the post interview of both of them. Mickelson was just very disappointed that he got a half, and then and Sergio went on and on about how disappointed he was and what the outcome was. And I just thought that was very, very interesting. And of course, it just was a great event. It is grown to because of the fact that we've been getting our butts kicked for so long, it's grown into a very, very popular and very exciting event. And we'll continue. It's gone into a new era. I mean, it used to be a friendly match against pros, and it was just kind of an opportunity to get together and compete. But you know, nowadays it's just a whole different ball game, and I'm excited. Of course, we're going over there next year. We'll see what we can do. But this task force they put together, I think they did a great job. I think it focuses our team, focuses on the event, and it helps us prepare. And just to have Phil 2 years ago open his mouth to get this process started, and of course he was the bad guy, and there was a lot of controversy this week with his comments on past captains, and I'll just leave that to those who watched it. And but you know, he had a purpose, and Mickelson's a smart guy, and he had a purpose, and I think his message is clear now. And you know, it really began 2 years ago in Scotland when he publicly criticized U.S. Captain Tom Watson, and that process developed what we now have. It put us in the right environment. The U.S. team came out with some amazing golf, and they brought the Ryder Cup because of the task force, and I think that's what started it. In any case, the Americans were a team, and that's really what made the difference. For the first time since 95, every U.S. player won at least one match, and that in itself is incredible. And for the first time since 2008, the Ryder Cup is going to stay in America. And you know, this was 4 years after Davis Love, the captain, then and now saw his team blow a 10-6 lead at Medina. And, you know, they just filled up the cup this time with birdies and eagles and, I mean, 263s. Amazing. There was a lot of pressure on them. And they obviously hadn't had a good run. And it's just exciting to see the cup come back to America, being in America. And this, you know, had they not won it, it would have been the fourth straight victory for the European team, and that's never happened. The fact that we'd lost three in a row had happened before, but to lose four in a row would have been just something that had never happened before. And it was great. And I can't imagine that Reed and McIlroy aren't hoarse after the 3 days. They were so pumped up, out-dueling and out-shouting each other. So I've got a special guest today, he's a good friend, Dalton McCrary, and Dalton's going to come on the show in a minute, and he's been to a Ryder Cup. He was at the Belfry in 2002, and we'll share his insights, and we're just going to talk about different things that occurred at the Ryder Cup, and I hope you enjoy the show, and let me go get Dalton and bring him in. So I want to welcome in my guest for today's show, Dalton McCrary from Dallas, Texas. Dalton and I go way back. We met in Las Vegas back about 1995-96 and kind of bumped into each other on a driving range at a local golf course here. Dalton had just been brought in and was the third or fourth teacher on the range. And so they had a big demo day, and I went over to demo and help one of the teachers there with club fitting, with my Henry Griffiths club fitting system. And they set me down on the end of the range, and there was this tall guy there with knickers, yellow knickers, and a kind of a bumblebee shirt and a yellow hat. It looked like Payne Stewart, and he had a crowd surrounding him, and I'm setting up, and he's got this sign up, and he goes, "I'll teach you how to hit it as straight as you can point it, guaranteed. And if I can't, I'll give you $100 back." And I had never heard or seen anything like that before. And he had a crowd down there, and he was hitting balls and holding court. So tell us, Dalton, how'd you end up there in Las Vegas when we met? I mean, you had just gotten into town. You hadn't been there more than a week.
I was teaching in Dallas. As a hobby, I enjoyed basketball officiating, and I was a Division I college basketball official for 25 years. So I called basketball in the wintertime, and I called talk golf in the summertime. And it got to be to the point to where my knees are hurting in basketball, and I'm loving golf. So I wanted to teach year-round. And one of my friends was the CEO for Golf Enterprises, and they managed a bunch of golf courses around the country. One of the ones that they managed was the Las Vegas Muni. And I asked him if I could go out there so I could teach year round. I think it was about 20 days a year you can't teach in Las Vegas. And he said, "Yeah, I can get you out there." So he sent me out to Las Vegas. And that first week, you know, we had that demo day, and they stuck me over to the end of the range, and it just happened to be sticking me next to you.
Yeah, it was fascinating. It really wasn't that busy, so I had a lot of time. So we started chatting, and you know, he had never really seen a fitting system before, and so I asked him, you know, had he done anything to his golf clubs? Because I could tell they were bent. And he goes, yeah, I bend them upright so I can hit the ball straight. And I went, well, you're one of the first teachers I've ever run into that's got that figured out. So we hit it off, obviously, really well. And it's amazing. Dalton, I'm going to let you talk a little bit about how you were discovered and the fact that you were the first golf pro to ever mention the word straight in any form of advertising.
Yeah, that was really unusual. I didn't realize that myself, but the word itself, just the word straight, just wasn't used in the golf industry for marketing, even talking about instruction. Back then, everybody said that was the hardest shot in golf to hit, and so you need to either allow your natural swing to work the ball left or work the ball right, so they just didn't use the word straight. And I had tried my best to get, when I got to Las Vegas, to put my little ad in those magazines that they have in all the hotel rooms. And I also wanted to get it in that in-flight magazine on the airlines, that Sky Mall magazine. And I managed to get it in there first, actually, before the rooms in Las Vegas. And Kevin Trudeau was going out to Las Vegas and saw my ad in that Sky Mall magazine. And when he got to Las Vegas, he called me up and wanted to take a lesson. And he came over and did. And he went back to Chicago and thought about it. And he came back out to Las Vegas and walked up to me on the driving range. Just had a handful of golf magazines in his hand that he had been reading through. And he said, Don, I can't find the word straight in any of these magazines. They don't even use the word straight. Is that something that's always been in the golf industry? And I said, I really didn't know. But no, they don't talk about straight as far as teaching concerned. And he said, well, let me put you on television. I can sell that in a closet. And that's exactly how it worked. It happened overnight, really. As you know, you and I were out there teaching for, 4 or 5 years before this happened. And it just happened. And it seemed like a month later, I woke up on a Saturday morning and my infomercials were running on 15, 20 channels at the same time on cable. It was amazing.
Yeah. You know, and for those of you who don't know, this was back, in the late 90s before the internet had taken off. And Kevin Trudeau was the guy behind Ron Peopel. He was the king of info commercials. Shamway, the Pocket Fisherman, the Memory Manager, all those, he had taken these individual products and subjects and individuals and made huge, huge money in info commercials. And Dalton, there were a few, I guess there might have been a few other golf videos floating around on TV at the time, but,
No, actually, they weren't. There weren't any. Really? The only thing that you ever saw television-wise was in between the commercial spots when they would air the PGA Tour on TV. But away from the telecast, you didn't see anything.
Yeah, that would make sense, because I know there was some people out there selling stuff on the Golf Channel, because it was just beginning to come into its own. It was an interesting time in golf, I must admit. They shoot these videos. They shoot them in Vegas, and I happened to kind of be there and watched a little bit of the production work. And next thing you know, Dalton sold 39,000 videos the first month and went on to sell over 4 million. Is that correct, Dalton?
Yeah, it was quite a deal when it they marketed the word straight. Since it never been used in the golf industry, they marketed the word straight. How to hit a golf ball as straight as you can point, guaranteed. And they bought the word straight, and it sold. It did 37,000 videos the first month, and after that, it didn't drop below 40,000 tape sales a month for 29 straight months. Quite a ride.
Pretty amazing. So, obviously, Dalton became a celebrity, and they were – The phone rooms where they sold the videos were also selling Dalton's golf schools. And having befriended Dalton at the time, I got on board and helped him conduct the golf schools in Vegas. And they were almost too big, Dalton. We had way too many. I mean, we were getting 35, 40 people showing up for a three-day school. And it was crazy. And we finally, over time, we ended up going to Texas and doing them, and we really got it down. We brought in some great instructors to help, and we really had a great time back then. And so, Dalton, tell me what's going on in your life now.
Well, when I got through with all the TV stuff, usually those TV shows get to a peak in sales, and then when they fall in a hurry, and you're off. Average lifespan on a infomercial show like that running is right at 2 years, and you're off the air. I got very lucky being the first one to say straight, because then they marketed me, as you know, in seven countries, and my show lasted 8 years on the air. So it was quite a run. But once it was over, back then, with no internet, the only thing that was there was AOL dial-up. Everybody was asking me questions. We're doing it, writing me a letter, and I couldn't answer all these letters longhand. And when I came off of television, I literally didn't do anything for the next 5 years at all. I just kind of retired. And when social media got really big, I had a gentleman holler at me and wanted to do a project with social media and wanted to use my tapes. And I asked him, well, okay, but what do you need from me? He said, just content. And it's really been a rejuvenation of my tapes, because now all of a sudden I get to talk to these golfers that bought these tapes over the years, where before there was no way I could. And I've really enjoyed that, the conversations I've had with people from Japan, New Zealand, Australia, all over Europe and the UK. It's been a really very nice ride in dealing with social media. And I've met some great, great, great teachers through social media also that I would have probably never met if it hadn't have been for that.
Well, this whole social media thing is, you know, we grew up, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And so, you know, we were kind of new to the whole thing. But it's, you know, obviously this podcast is part of that kind of program style now. And it gives us just so many different options to reach out and touch people. And it's really fascinating. And so a lot of things going on in the golf world these days, Dalton. Yesterday was this last week we saw the passing of Arnold Palmer, and then we had the Ryder Cup. And then yesterday they had the memorial for Arnold, and it was just amazing. Some great, great stuff. So if you're a golf fan, it's been kind of an interesting couple of weeks. And Dalton, share if you would like to share a little bit on Arnold and the influence he had on the game.
Oh gosh, you know, Arnie was the first coming of the first superstar that had some charisma and some personality out there. Arnie's Army was a big deal. His whole mannerisms, he was just – and besides that, you know, Arnold was one of the most likable people that you'd ever want to see in your life. Had a great memory, remembered you, remembered your kids. Always made you feel like you were just one of the most special people in the world to him. Every time he met anybody, he was just a very special person that very few people are like that.
Well, I doubt you'll ever. I mean, he came along at a time, Dalton, as you and I both know, that when TV first hit. And, you know, I remember sitting in front of the TV with my dad back in late 50s, early 60s, when TV found golf. And and literally was kind of coming into the sports world. And Arnold was so marketable, and so, I mean, so that he literally, I think, one of his greatest legacies is going to be how he changed the sports marketing world in general. He hooked up with McCormick, obviously, and the rest is kind of history. And they did a one-on-one thing, and they just realized that advertising and sponsorship, and they put it on the map, corporate sponsorship. And I think you see these sports management companies today, and they can thank Arnold for pioneering the way for all of that in all sports, Dalton. So I think, you know, that and the fact that you're never going to see another high-end professional athlete learn to fly and fly his own jet around the world anymore. So, and he started that whole trend of flying and getting control of your life. And I believe, you know, you can see Wheels Up and Net Jets and all these airplane leasing companies have definitely benefited from the presence of Arnold Palmer.
And the fact that he was winning. And the biggest rivalry to Jack is he started winning. It just made for an exciting time of golf. And let's see, he was coming in as Hogan was going out, wasn't he?
Yeah. And you know, he got kind of pissed off at Hogan in that Masters. And I think it was 58 or 59, and he ended up winning it. But, you know, he wasn't playing very well coming in. And Hogan said, why is this guy at this tournament? Literally had no respect for Arnold. And Arnold went out and won the tournament. There was a neat little anecdote in the memorial yesterday where he was sitting around. This is after he's retired, and they're sitting up in the clubhouse talking, and his friend asks him, "So Arnold, did you ever consider laying up on 13 and 15 at the Masters?" And there was this pause, and he looked back and he goes, "John, how many times did I finish second at the Masters?" And his friend sits there and thinks a little bit, and he goes, "You know, Arnold, I don't really know." And he said, "Neither do I." and winked at him. So he was a go-for-broke kind of guy, hitching up his pants, smoking that cigarette. He was just made for TV, man. The king is gone, and we're going to put him to rest now and kind of shift gears. Kind of want Dalton to give a little input on his take on the Ryder Cup right now. So, Dalton, what was your take on the Ryder Cup this year?
Wasn't that incredible? It really was. After the last six Ryder Cups that we've lost, to see the level of play at this one was absolutely remarkable. I think DL3 having the rough cut a little bit shorter definitely made for more birdie attempts and a lot more going from broke toward shooting at the pin with both teams. It was just incredibly exciting. I've never seen that many birdies being made team by team in any Ryder Cup. You knew what was the percentage of birdies that they had that you were telling me?
Well, in the final round, they had 100. The golfers had 120 birdies, and there were multiple eagles. And interestingly enough, Justin Rose in the post Ryder Cup interviews suggested that the course pin placements were just too easy. And the reality is, everybody plays the same golf course. Everybody was firing it up. It was so exciting. The match between Roy and Reed was incredible. I mean, it was one of the greatest displays of sportsmanship and competition that you've ever seen at the Ryder Cup. And then, you know, six groups back, you have Phil and 20-year rivals, Phil Mickelson and Garcia, playing each other heads up. And between the two of them, Dalton, they shot best ball 58. Phil had 10 birdies and a bogey, and Sergio had 9 birdies. And they both shot 63 and halved, and they were both pissed.
Well, I can understand it.
Yeah. Well, particularly Phil.
That's probably the first match. That's probably the first match that's ever had two guys go that low, isn't it? Ryder Cup.
No question. And they were, I mean, all the matches were exciting because they were just firing at the pins. The pins were kind of in the middle of the green, and they weren't tucked in the corners. And it was just – they were still making bombs. I mean, there was one hole when between the two of them, Reed and McIlroy made 80 feet of putts. They both drained. I think Reed was 45 feet and McIlroy was 35 feet or something, and they both made their putts. And it was like, and that was the roar that backed Phil off his 3-foot birdie putt seven holes behind him. That's how loud it was. So it was just a great, great event. It was great for golf, and I look forward, and I think everybody now is really excited. The Ryder Cup has stepped it up. It's an event of its own. And you know, back in the day when we were watching it when we were younger, it was just kind of an exhibition match. It wasn't that big of a deal, and they, you know, just guys getting together and but the interesting thing is the Arnold Palmer's bag was sitting on the first tee, and all the Europeans, everybody respected it. But the last time the Americans had swept a session was in 1975 when Arnold was on the team. And so very touching. It was just an amazing week with Arnold passing, and 3 days of the life of Arnold, and then the Ryder Cup, and then the Memorial. It's been a great, really enjoyable week for golf. And I just can't say enough about the Ryder Cup. I mean, obviously it's over now, and most of our listeners have probably their own opinions on it. So feel free, if you have questions on the show, by the way, and want to get a hold of me or Dalton, you can contact us at info@golfpodcast.com. Just send us an email. And if you want to get a hold of Dalton and talk to him, Dalton, briefly let him know how to reach you right now.
Facebook's the easiest way. Dalton McCrary on Facebook. Or Dalton Straight Talking Golf on Facebook. Either one. That's where I do most of my conversations is on Facebook. That's one of the greatest things I've ever seen is the social media aspects of Facebook.
Yeah, we're members of several teaching groups out there, and it's fun to just share ideas. There's some great instructors out there. One of my favorites is Michael Hebron. I love his postings on learning and coaching, and there's just some. We've made some great relationships out on Facebook. It's changed the way I think we meet and share ideas, and so there's some great aspects to it. I think sometimes people get a little out of hand with it, but it's fun. It's fun to share ideas and chat with different people from around the world.
It is interesting to listen to some of the teacher blogs, isn't it?
No, it is. there's some passionate people out there that believe in one thing, and you know, both of us over all the years, you know, it's the one fundamental that I think all great players have is just balance. And I think weight transfer and balance and just simple concepts like that. I mean, our goal is just to help the student get the most out of their game. It's not what we believe. It's what we can get them to understand that would help them move forward. It's always looking for that one or two things that'll really make a difference for them so that we can get them to a point where we can then maybe add a little bit more. But you know, I'm a big believer in playing to learn. Dalton, we see all these guys on the driving range just pounding golf balls for hours. And it tickles me a lot because I always want to walk up and go, you know, by the way, you don't play golf on the driving range. So it's interesting how the golf swing is just a small part of the game. And I think we know that. So we've got some, we've had this great, you know, last 10 to 12 days in golf. But now we've got something pretty exciting coming up next week, and that's the reappearance of Tiger on the PGA Tour. I think that's going to be great. And tell us what we were talking earlier, Dalton. Tell us what Parnevik had to say about Tiger.
Well, I understand that Jasper's been playing a few rounds with Tiger. Supposedly Tiger's strapping the ball pretty good.
Yeah, he's down the Medalist Club. He said he's flushing it. He thinks that you know, comebacks are hard. I mean, I think throughout our careers, when we were aspiring to play at higher levels, it's we found out how frustrating golf can be when you can go out and shoot 64 one day and 84 the next day. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm kind of excited about Tiger showing back up.
You know, he set the bar higher than anybody could jump over it. And his excitement on the tour, I mean, seriously, since the tour has not had Tiger, have you watched golf on TV as much as you did when Tiger was playing?
Well, I would say the majors, obviously, always. I think probably not as much.
And see, that's the thing. You know, we're in the business and try and keep up with golf. And there was so much excitement around Tiger that when he couldn't play anymore, we even lost interest in the overall TV tour golf, except for the majors. We just didn't watch them anymore. It wasn't as exciting. It hadn't been exciting for years before he got there. And as soon as he leaves, the whole atmosphere of golf on television just changes, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's happened throughout history. I mean, when Arnold showed up on the scene, golf had kind of gotten a little bit dormant. It just wasn't, you know, it was kind of the end of the era of the Nelsons and the Hogans. And then here comes Arnie hitching up his pants and TV. And then Jack shows up. And so now we have the rivalry. And of course, Jack was the bad guy. And then there was Watson and Trevino and Player, and the big three obviously kind of drove it through the 60s into the 70s. But then we kind of had another lull again, and we just really didn't have the rivalries and the excitement that brought a lot of viewers to TV. And then the Golf Channel starts in 95, and here comes Tiger Woods, and a whole nother era of boom in golf. And the baby boomers we grew up watching Tiger. I mean, he was the guy. And now, you know, as he's faded out, obviously the TV numbers have gone down, as Dalton mentioned, but I see the difference in the game and the physical conditioning. Tiger drove all that. I mean, it's just such a different game. And I think one of the problems, and I'll let you expound, is that I think now there's too much attention on the pro golf swing. And I think the pro golf swing is an incredible – I mean, we've broken down the biomechanics and everything, but for the average guy out there to try to teach him what the pros are doing is kind of ludicrous. And I just think that maybe one of the problems in golf instruction today is there's way too much emphasis. I mean, guys are going into these golf places all over the place and they're beating balls and looking at the camera and trying to get this perfect golf swing. And, you know, if you're a good athlete, you might be able to perform at a higher level by understanding all that stuff. But in reality, way too much information in my mind.
Well, you're absolutely right. They've broken the golf swing down into the you and I have just talked about it so much. You know, the big deal to us was always we knew so much that we knew what not to say.
Yeah, and it takes a while to figure that out too.
And it does. And now you have all these new breed of technical teachers that go into these case studies and try and prove all these theories. And I'm just waiting for them to gain enough knowledge for them to know what not to say also.
Yeah, funny. Funny.
You know, our idea in golf was teaching somebody was trying to see how fast we could make ourselves unnecessary.
Exactly.
And with all this technology, you and I are now deemed the old school antiquated teachers.
Right.
If you don't use all that technology, you're not keeping up with all that there is to know about the golf swing. And there's just so much that we've learned that we don't need to know, and we daggum sure don't need to go telling anybody.
Yeah. And, you know, we try all the different theories. We say, oh, yeah, okay, let me try that. And so we're out there experimenting around. Our games go to poop, and then we go back to what we know is the truth, and it becomes simple again. It's crazy. You know, it's just information overload. And I'm working with a lot of juniors now. And so the goal is to just get them to participate in a sport. And golf is a sport that many kids could really do well at if they just got the right exposure. So we get them just moving and making motions. We don't get real mechanical. And so it's great to, there's a time and a place to take it to the next level. But I remember when video came out, Dalton, back in the late 80s, and we all jumped on board. And I've got, I've been teaching for 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden I introduced video into my teaching. And after about a year, I began to realize, my students really aren't getting any better using this video. In fact, most of the gals I was working with would look at the camera, and they were looking at their outfit and how bad they looked. And instead of paying, and it was just, and then, of course, MIT did a study on visual learning and video, and it found out it was one of the least effective ways to teach. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. So, and yet now we have launch monitors, and we analyze spin rates and do everything. And, at the highest level in the game, all that stuff is so beneficial. But to know how far you hit your golf clubs is a really cool deal. And so we have the tools to help people understand their golf swing. And it's their golf swing. It's should be built around what they're capable of doing, what their practice schedule's like, and how much time they can devote to it. So,
you're absolutely right. The new breed of golfer that Tiger brought along is all of a sudden we have the golf athlete that we didn't have before Tiger. And this new tour swing that they keep talking about, which is all you hear on the Golf Channel and all you hear when they broadcast television, that tour swing, that requires you to be an athlete in peak condition to be able to pull off the swings that they show on tour. The average weekend golfer just can't do that. I've watched, one of my friends that teaches that's a golfing machine instructor and teaches Homer Kelly's theories. He told me point blank, I wouldn't even consider teaching a weekend golfer this. It's the wrong move for them. And when you look at all these sites on the internet and YouTube showing, they always compare the weekend golfer swing to the tour. And I sure think they ought to compare weekend golfers to weekend golfers.
Yeah, I'll give you an anecdote on that, Dalton. And by the way, we're both golf machine instructors. We know how to use it effectively. And I'm so proud that I went through that program because it opened my eyes to a lot of things. But to get to your little story about, I have a gal who came to me who had, and I won't mention the outfit she was working with, but she had gone in and paid $4,500 to take, I don't know, a year's worth of golf lessons. And she was on lesson 12 or 13, and they were comparing, she's 5'1", tiny little gal, and they decided that her swing should emulate Stuart Appleby's, who's got to be 6'3" or 6'4". And so they were modeling her swing after Stuart Appleby, and they had her at lesson 12 at about waist high in the backswing. And I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. I said, you're not even making full swings after 12 lessons? No, I'm trying to get the club in the right position at waist high in the backswing. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe I'm doing something wrong. But, I mean, it was scary. In an hour and a half coaching section, I got her in balance on her front foot and got her posture and got her backswing a little better. It was crazy. She was spending so much time, going to the waist high and turning and looking at it that she was leaning at the target. And then when she'd try to make a swing, she couldn't get airborne because she was tilted so heavily to the left. The club was coming in so steep, she was smothering everything. So
You know, and that's one of the, that's one of the things that I enjoyed about being next to you all those years with your club fitting, learning how to help somebody through club fitting and getting to, them to swing to balance and be able to feel that golf club, the head of that golf club as they swing from the get-go, just made a huge difference in how I approach teaching after being around you and club fitting all those years.
Yeah, it's equipment affects motion. There's no question about it. And I was fortunate enough to get on board with Henry Griffiths, who pioneered club fitting, by the way, and owns over 90 patents in the industry. We changed how the industry approached, and of course now everybody supposedly club fits. But keep in mind that it's better than nothing. But the masses, you know, the major OEMs fit the masses, so they have to make assumptions. And so if you're, you know, if you're out there and you're thinking about equipment, and by all means, know this too. If you don't think you're good enough to get good equipment, you're fooling yourself. Because if you're out there trying to get better and your equipment doesn't reward you with the proper ball flight when you make a good motion, you're going to continue to compensate and your feedback's going to be confusing. So I would highly recommend that anyone out there should get fit equipment. And there's multiple different ways you can do it. Obviously, Henry Griffiths is one choice. And you can find us at henrygriffiths.com. You can go there. You can link over to my podcast page and my golf my golf site, my blog site, www.vegasgolfcoach.com. There'll be links to Henry Griffiths there and links to Roadrunner Golf, the coaching centers, and you'll find all kinds of cool information out. Dalton, do you have a website up where they can reach you, or are you just mostly doing social media?
The website is being redone. It is www.straighttalkinggolf.com, but we're redoing it right now. I'm going over to Portugal at the end of this month to shoot two more videos, and we're shooting to have the website up at the same time we edit those videos and get them out on the market for the holiday season.
So are the videos going to be available for download online now? Is that how you're going to do it?
That's the reason we're redoing the website, because we were partnering with Nevada Bob's over in the UK to be able to order the tapes and the downloads. But we didn't have the whereabouts to do so on our website, but that's what we're doing now is making it where we're the only place that you can get them.
Oh, that's good. That's good. That'll be good. I can't wait. I'd like to get some. I actually have some of the original signed copies that you signed for me, Dalton. So I've still got them in the archives somewhere in my bookshelves. So
back when those were VHS tapes.
Yeah, they were. And the boxes they came in were like notebooks. I mean, it was huge. I mean, it was a lot of fun. So we got a little bit more time here, Dalton. So talk a little bit more about your philosophy a little bit on teaching, and let's just kind of stay on the teaching and the club fitting area. I think our listeners would be like to hear a little bit about that.
Well, you know, golf is not that rocket science, as I've always told people. It's a lot.
My famous quote.
Yeah,
I use it all the time, Dalton. Thanks to you, I stole it. Yeah. Golf ain't rocket science.
You know, it's physics, you know. I started watching old tapes years ago of Bobby Jones, and even in the Hogan era, when the camera wasn't fast enough to stop the blur of the club head. If you remember years ago when we used to watch old Western movies, and they'd be in a wagon or a stagecoach and the wheels looked like they were going backward. That's because the speed of the camera wasn't fast enough. And as I started looking at still pictures, the camera couldn't stop the blur of the shaft as they swung either. And I would read what they would say about this golf swing, and then I would look at the blur on the picture, and that's not what's happening. if they were doing what they're telling me they were doing, that golf club wouldn't be blurred like it's blurred. And that's really what opened my eyes to what I was doing wrong myself. was just strictly realizing what the blur was doing, and I was just trying to make my club blur like I saw the pictures on these different posts were, and that's was a huge, huge difference to me. When I figured out that one aspect of where do you start letting go of the golf club so you can get it back square, it made sense to me. It was like Newton's law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That meant the last thing to stop on your backswing was the first thing to start coming down. And the last thing to stop on your backswing is the club head. Then I started looking at other people's instruction, and I got to reading Nicklaus's Golf My Way. And in Golf My Way, Jack said, as soon as I start transferring my weight left, I'm releasing the club head with my hands and wrist. That wasn't a delay to me.
Yeah, the weight transfer creates the delay.
And the then you've got to let it go. Yes, that's what we were talking about, was the myth of still pictures.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even Hogan said, you know, once you get it loaded, he wished he had five right hands to let it go. But, you know, the key was the weight transfer initiated the lag, which allowed the club to drop in, and then you could just let it go as hard as you wanted.
Hogan was one of my favorite pictures. I've got this picture of Hogan with the club about his arm was parallel. The club was nearly straight up in the air coming down. But I looked at the blur, and his hands are so big in this picture. And it finally dawned on me that the reason his hands were blurred so big is because, yes, he's pulling down, as they say in instruction. And that's what blurred his hands up and down. But he's also releasing the club head at the same time and timing it to get square to impact. And that meant that his hands were also blurred across. And that's what made his hands so big. And that was a huge deal to me on my personal swing to realize, oh, gosh, I mistook what they were saying.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there. But, yeah, it was you know, and I did the same thing. I mean, I read Jack's book and I read Hogan's book and I tried to emulate the pictures in it. And then I'd watch, you know, Golf Magazine would come out and I'd stare at all the still pictures in it and try to figure out, you know, I guess, you know, my figure is, well, if these guys are the best golfers in the world, I need to try to emulate what they're doing the best I can. And that's all we had back then. I mean, we kind of dug it out of the dirt. I remember, you know, when I first met you, you talking about the tire drill, and I want you to kind of elaborate on that. But quick story, my first pro in Alice, Texas, when I was 10 years old, threw a tire in the back and told me to beat it till I got to the fence. And I want you to elaborate on what that tire drill is all about.
Well, when you say, and we say, back when we were kids and learning the swing ourselves, we just dug a swing out of the dirt. What that means, golfers, is what you're trying to do is do the same thing over and over enough that you see the positions that your body is in at impact. That's the reason that I use a tire, because I wanted to see exactly what position my body was in at impact. And I got that from Henry Cotton. You can go on YouTube and look at Henry Cotton. He was back in the 30s was teaching this. But you swing into a tire and it'll stop you. And I could see what my body was in, the position it was in at impact. And then you do it enough till your mind gets the feel of the movement that it sees. And once it makes the connection with the movement it sees with the feel of the movement, then your golf swing is pretty well set. That's what I've always believed. And that's the reason I hit that tire over and over and over and over and over. If you can get in the same position at impact, swinging into that tire over and over and over in your backyard, you ought to be able to do it all day long on a golf course.
Well, Dalton, if you don't shoot a video on that tire drill and put it up somewhere where people can download it and watch it, I think you're missing a big opportunity there, because You know, as I said, I mean, Tommy Aycock, who was played on the tour back in the 50s and 60s, was the head pro at my little country club in Alice, Texas. And he had me beating a tire, and I didn't understand it. I mean, he didn't really even explain it to me. He just drew it on the ground, gave me an old 5-iron, told me to hit it. And I was doing it entirely wrong. And then he finally, after I got so frustrated after about 20 minutes, he came out and actually put me into the position he wanted me to be in when I hit the tire. And he was teaching me impact. And impact is the moment of truth in golf, if you know, for our listeners out there. It doesn't matter how you get there, because there's, according to, and you know this too, according to Homer Kelly, there's 259 quadrillion different ways you can be perfect in impact. And that's based on 2 basic strokes and 26 components, and it gets outrageous. But we could go on and on, but truthfully, exponentially speaking, you can mix and match everything as long as you're good at impact. There's no limit. There is no model. It's just golf your way. And I think learning impact is a powerful, powerful thing. And I teach all of my students impact. I teach them absolutely where they're supposed to be, where the low point is. I think melodic instructors, you know, I pull my students all the time. One of the first questions I ask a lot of them is, so if you want to get this ball airborne, do you hit the bottom, middle, or the top of the ball? And 95% of them, unless they're advanced golfers and they've been on, you know, out there, but if they're a beginner, they're going to tell me, oh, you got to hit the bottom to get it up. And that's what creates so many bad motions in golf. And unfortunately, that's kind of what happens. Your buddies take you to the golf course and the ball's sitting on the ground and you're trying not to embarrass yourself and you start trying to get it in the air and you use the tool, the golf club, incorrectly. Irons for centuries have had forward shaft lean, and you need to return that golf club back to the ball with the grip end ahead of the head if you want to compress it and swing down and through to low point. And when you try to hit the bottom of the ball, you're releasing the club head early and your hands are behind the club head and all kinds of bad things start happening. So that impact drill probably took me to the next level when I was a kid in golf, because I was clueless. I was out there just, you know, slicing up and smiling my Beretta golf balls, topping them and fatting them. And all of a sudden, you know, this one pro showed me what impact was all about and how to, and it was, again, like you said, Dalton, just repetition, getting into that position over and over. And then suddenly it just started occurring in my golf swing.
You know, when I was a kid, I hooked the golf ball, massive hook. I'd line up in the right tree line and I'm going to take it out over it and come back in. And hopefully it gets down in the fairway and stops before it gets on the other side. But when you have a golf swing like that and you're hitting it over the tree, sometimes it doesn't come back and you're way out there.
Really? Really? You mean?
And really? I'd be playing with my dad. And I'd hit one off to the right, and as soon as I'd hit it, my dad would yell, "Pushed it, Dad! Now I can see that." tell me why I pushed it. And his comment to me always was, "Well, you didn't wait on the club head," and that made total sense to me. I didn't wait on it; it didn't have enough time to get square. I hit the ball with the club face wide open, and it went to the right. That made sense to me. My next question was, "Dad, why didn't I wait on the club head?" Well, you just didn't.
Yeah.
That didn't help me. It took me a long time before I realized, you know, if you're pushing the ball off to the right, you might want to start releasing the club head further back. Give yourself more time to get it square.
Yeah, I'll tell you my dad's story. My dad had a famous quote for me too. You know, I hit a big slice. I mean, my clubs were cut down Hogan medallions, and there's a long story behind that, and my family's relationship with Fort Worth and the Hogans and my grandparents anyway. So I have these cut off medallion, you know, just, and I couldn't. I mean, I'm 10 years old and I can't barely lift the freaking club. It weighed so much, and the lie angles were all jacked up. But I hit everything. I hit slices all the time, and I'd stand on the tee, man, and I'd hit one, and this golf course is cut out of this mesquite tree line, little South Texas golf course, and I'd hit one out in the trees, you know, And my dad, we'd be walking off the tee, and I'd be kind of upset, and he'd go, you know, son, if you're going to miss it in the fairway. And that was the only lesson or saying anything he ever told me about golf, miss it in the fairway. And to this day, I still hear him, son, you got to miss it in the fairway. I tell you what I did get good at is hitting 3 irons out from under the trees. I had the low ball figured out, my man.
Well, growing up in South Texas, you're like me growing up in West Texas. We learned to hit the ball low just because the wind blew all the time.
Yeah. You know what? Here in Vegas, there's some definite golf courses out here where the wind blows all the time. So, you know, I feel like when the wind's blowing now, Dalton, I got an advantage over some of the other golfers.
And you do.
Yeah, it's so much fun. I crank up the wind, man. I might be able to win the pot.
Absolutely.
So how often? I hear you're in Odessa right now, visiting some friends, playing a little golf out there. When are you going to be back in Dallas?
I'm heading back to Dallas tomorrow.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I came out here to visit with my oldest friends. People that know stories about me that are actually true.
Yeah. Well, you had your celebrity days. There's no question about it. I really enjoyed working with you, particularly when we were down in Horseshoe Bay outside of Austin in Texas. That was just a wonderful, wonderful deal for us down there. And it was kind of, I guess when we folded up the schools there in 2000. We were both kind of lost. I mean, what are we going to do next? And I eventually went back to work as a regional training director for Henry Griffiths and got back into teaching and fitting again. But there was a small time frame after that where I thought about doing other things. And then I realized that, you know, my passion has always been golf and particularly mentoring juniors and working with beginners. And it's good. It's good to have you back in the game, Dalton. It was good, you know, when you popped back up and we started reconnecting. I know we kind of lost each other and didn't communicate a lot for 4, 5, 6 years. But then you came out to Sacramento. We were going to try to redo. This was 1995, and we were going to try to start some golf schools back up. And we hooked up again and got.
Oh, that was 2005.
Yeah, excuse me, 2005. Yep. And we had bopped off to the golf machine. I finished my certification, and you went in and kind of opened up our eyes to some different possibilities. We built that learning center there at Wild Horse in Davis and took off, and we just couldn't get it back off the ground, the golf school portion of it.
Well, now that social media is there, you know, with what you're doing and what I'm doing, we're developing that customer base back that Trudeau wouldn't let me have. You know, when we sold that many videos and they wouldn't let me have the customer base to do more camps is, you know, only reason that we stopped then.
Exactly.
But we're just about to get the customer base, and there's nothing I'd rather do than hook up with you and do some more of those golf camps out in Vegas.
Yeah, and we've got
way too much fun out there.
Perfect location. We're right. You know, I'm currently at the Las Vegas Country Club. I've got the two indoor about golf simulators and a beautiful outdoor practice facilities. It's one of the most elite golf courses in town. Probably the finest Parkland golf course in town. And we are definitely, Dalton and I are definitely going to look into bringing out some golf schools here shortly. And we're just a matter of getting a database built back up and. I look forward to that so much, Dalton. You know, it's so much fun, and we've got the perfect place to do it right across from the Westgate where we can put them into timeshares and suites and come on out. And if you're listening in and just pay close attention, you can reach me at thevegasgolfcoach.com. My website will link you over to my Roadrunner Golf Coaching Center sites. Dalton, you can find him on Facebook.
Well, if you just go on any search engine, Google, and just put in Dalton McCrary, I come up and all the websites and YouTube, everything is listed there, just 1, 2, 3, 4, and you just click on them. They're all right there in one place.
Yep, and it's pretty much you can click on the Vegas Golf Coach or Gaylord Rhodes, your host, and find me there. And Dalton, I look forward to doing these golf schools again with you. And we have the perfect place to do it. And we've been talking about it for a while. And I'm excited to get you down. When are you going down to Portugal to reshoot?
the 30th of this month. Be up there during Halloween.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, let's hope that gets done and gets, and then when it does, we're going to have you back on the show and we're going to be talking about how they can find us and come to Vegas and play golf. So, obviously, VegasGolfCoach.com, and it's golfpodcast.com is where you find the show, and you can, and there'll be links there as well. Dalton's on Facebook. You can just spell your last name for him, Dalton, so they can find you.
It's MCCRARY.
Yep. And I'm sure if you get close, he'll be there somewhere because he has a very strong presence on the internet and is very easy to track down.
Oh, gosh, you can just put in Dalton Street shooting golf and it comes up.
Yeah, exactly. Very, you know, I mean, when you've done what Dalton's done in the industry, it's pretty easy to find him. So I was thrilled to meet you back in Las Vegas and to start this journey with you. And it's time for us to do some more golf schools together and have some more fun. And for all you listeners out there, we hope that you'll stay tuned. And if you ever come to Vegas, look me up, VegasGolfCoach.com, and come on out to the golf and center and let's talk off. Let's look at your game and let's dial your swing in and look forward to Dalton's new releases, and I'm sure it's going to be some good stuff. And I look forward to him getting into that database and start putting schools together for us.
Oh, I do too, partner. And we have just had too much fun. We need to do it again.
Yeah, it's time. It's and we're both in a position now where we're back full circle. And that's kind of what happens in golf. You kind of have your hey, you know, you had your day in the sun from 97 to 2000. And really kind of dominated golf schools at the time. And you know, all through all the greats, you know, the Ledbetters and the Ballards and all those guys, they've all kind of come and had their heyday. And then they kind of back away and do their thing, do what they have a passion for. And we've known all these guys. And we've been mentored by some great people. And so, you know, we might be old school, Dalton, but we got the truth. We know the truth.
You know, yes, we
never
do.
Underestimate the power of age. You know, it's like why all the young golfers used to go hang out with Arnie when they made it on the tour because they wanted to get his wisdom. And when you got guys like Dalton and I and some of the other great instructors, what we call our old school got buddies, with 30, 40 years of experience in teaching golf, you're not going to find a better instructor than someone who has that kind of experience because we've seen it come and go. We've seen what works and what doesn't work, and we know really how to communicate. And I think one of the basic problems in golf instruction is it's communication. If the student doesn't understand what you're saying to them, you're not making any sense. They're not going to benefit from. You've got to be able to speak in a language they can understand. You've got to be able to pick out the one or two things that are going to make a difference. And then communicate that in a way they can understand in their learning language. And so, you know, we've done all this for years, and I want to thank you for coming into the show, Dalton. We're just about out of time here. Can you please let everybody know how to get a hold of him? And thanks for coming, Dalton. And next time we have Dalton on, we'll be talking golf schools.
Oh, I appreciate it, Gaylord, very much. I enjoyed it. And you can find me at Dalton Street Shooting Golf. Just Google it, and I come up everywhere. Golfers, I'm real easy to find. Thank you, Gaylord.
Talk to you soon.
All righty, bud.
Well, folks, it's time to say goodbye to this episode of Fairways and Greens. Hope you enjoyed the show. And if you would like to subscribe to the show, just head over to the golfcoachpodcast.com. That's www.golfcoachpodcast.com. And don't forget to reach out with your questions and your input on the show to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. So reach out with your questions and Anything you'd like to add or any suggestion on future shows to info@golfcoachpodcast.com. And you can find me, the Vegas Golf Coach, and a link to my blogs, coaching centers, and programs at www.vegasgolfcoach.com. That's www.vegasgolfcoach.com. So goodbye for now, and here's to finding your share of fairways and greens in your journey through life and golf.
This podcast was a presentation of LightUpMedia.fm.